Welcome to Holy Unhappiness, conversations about the expectations we have of what the life of faith will feel like. I'm your host, Amanda Held Opelt, author of the book Holy Unhappiness, God, Goodness, and the Myth of the Blessed Life. Each week, I'll be speaking with writers, pastors, artists, and friends about the myths we believe about the good life. Together, we'll reimagine what blessing can look like if we are willing to look beyond our culture's definition of happiness and success. Welcome. I'm glad you're here. A bit of a hiatus here at the Holy Unhappiness podcast, but I wanted to bring the podcast back in honor of Mental Health Awareness Month, which has actually been observed during the month of May since 1949. In my book, Holy Unhappiness, I share what it was like to experience emotions and feelings that I couldn't really explain. Feelings that I thought meant I was unholy or had strayed from my righteous belonging in God. My sadness, my frustration, my anxiety often felt like a spiritual failure. And the shame I had for having those feelings was really overwhelming at times. One thing I've been thinking about a lot lately is how amazing it is that we are often willing to extend compassion and kindness to others, and yet we don't extend that same compassion and kindness to ourselves. Since I was young, I have always believed in the validity of the experiences of those who struggle with mental health challenges. My time working in social services taught me that some people grapple with very real mental, emotional, and psychological trials. And I affirmed their desire to seek help. In fact, my job was to help connect them to help. And later, when I worked as a staff care advisor for international aid workers, I completed trainings in trauma awareness and psychological first aid, and I believed with my whole self that trauma is an experience that cannot be ignored or denied or spiritually bypassed, but that must be named and addressed and resourced. And yet, I failed to believe that trauma could impact me. I failed to believe that I might be mentally, spiritually, and emotionally overwhelmed by my own difficult experiences. So I don't know, maybe it was pride, maybe it was a misunderstanding of what it meant to cope or to be strong, but for whatever reason, my journey in understanding my own mental health challenges is really something that has only begun in earnest in recent years. Maybe just because I was unwilling to admit that I was really struggling. Now, it's not my intention here to go into the specifics of my own mental health struggles or diagnosis. Those are details that are sacred and precious to me and that I've shared with family and friends and pastors who are journeying closely with me in my everyday life here in Boone. And I also want to name that I affirm and have benefited from mental health resources like meeting with a licensed counselor like twice a month. And there are seasons of my life where I have benefited from medication that targeted my mental health struggles. Really, the purpose of reviving this podcast right now is to just join the conversation that is happening in the church about the reality of mental health. It's a conversation that I wish was more robust, more integrated, more informed. But I want to be part of it because I believe the spiritual and the physical are not separate. I believe sacred work and pastoral work have a role to play in our mental well-being, but that care must be offered with precision and awareness and nuance and tenderness. For the next 5 weeks, I'll be bringing in specialists on this topic, licensed counselors, psychologists, pastors, and grief specialists to talk about how we can approach this issue with the sensitivity and compassion it warrants and deserves. And today, my first guest is someone whose work I hope you've read or have been exposed to already. Andy Kolber is a licensed professional counselor, MALPC, and the best-selling author of the critically acclaimed Try Softer, the Try Softer Guided Journey, and her newest offering, Strong Like Water and Strong Like Water Guided Journey. She has received additional training in her specialization of trauma and body-centered therapies and is passionate about the integration of faith and psychology. Andy has appeared on Good Morning America, regularly speaks at national events, and is a frequent guest on podcasts such as The Lazy Genius, Typology, and The Next Right Thing. And now she's a guest on the Holy Unhappiness podcast. As a survivor of trauma, Andy brings hard-won knowledge about the work of change, the power of redemption, and the beauty of experiencing God with us in our pain. I hope you listen in. I think you're going to really enjoy this conversation. Andy, I want to thank you so much for coming on to the podcast. I'm such an admirer of your work and your presence in the world. So yeah, welcome. Welcome onto the podcast.
Absolutely. It's really good to be with you.
I can't tell you how many friends I have and family I have where I've been to their house and I've seen your books on their bookshelf and we talk about it and they say, you know, oh, this is what I felt when I read her words and this is what I experienced. This is how it helped me. And I resonate with what they say. I've loved everything that you've ever written. And we'll come back to this at the end, but I want to say congratulations on just releasing a companion work to your latest book from last year, Strong Like Water. Tell us a little bit about what that companion book is and the purpose that it serves.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for those kind words and just sharing that because it's so special. It's surreal to know that something you've done. And I know you know what that's like too, but just to have something that you've done touch other people and to then hear about it like second, third hand is pretty cool. So my newest offering, Strong Like Water Guided Journey is this companion book to Strong Like Water. And really, you know, sometimes I joke around with all like both Try Softer and Strong Like Water. I kind of talk about it like it's almost like herding cats to explain these very nuanced, intricate concepts that, you know, I think are all so helpful. Mm-hmm. But it's like this wrangling of saying, like, how do we take these things that I think are so helpful and how do we bring them into the reader in a way that feels cohesive and helpful? Mm-hmm. And so what I love about the guided journey is that I hope and I believe that it sort of helps continue to synthesize these concepts.
Yeah.
And I hope it invites folks to allow the content to become even more experiential for them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that it goes from being like, hey, here's a story I read, which is great, to being like, hey, can I help you to allow this to become part of who you are?
Yeah.
And so in many ways, it's like the guided journey, it has story work, but it's also body centered and there's art journaling and there's questions for potentially groups. There's potential for, you know, your own reflection. So it's kind of thinking about the fact that we just all learn things in so many different ways and hoping to help people with that.
Yeah. I love that. You and I were chatting earlier in the month and you posted this online too, that the week of your launch, your whole family was sick, which, you know, for people who aren't authors, they don't maybe know all the effort and kind of the emotional buildup that goes into the actual day of a launch, the week of a launch. And it was interesting that the day of my very first book launch, my first book was about grief. I actually ended up going to a funeral. And I remember Tim kind of saying to me on the way over there, he was like, well, this feels a little bit on brand for you, Amanda. But it was just like, you know, I went to a funeral. And then for my second book launch, I had to go to a CT scan because of some health issues I was having. Unfortunately, things checked out in the clear and all that. But it's just a reminder that like,
life is happening, even as you are trying to kind of put this work out into the world. And, you know, this kind of the glamorous idea of like, you know, I know I had built it up in my mind that this week of the launch was going to be this just incredible celebratory thing. And it was just, no, it's just life. Like, just another week with more life and more heartache and more real struggle. You know what I mean? So I am sorry that you guys were struggling that week, but I'm like, Oh, I'm glad I'm not the only one that has had all of my plans curtailed for my launch week. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, it is really, I mean, you know, just life. Yeah. Life continues. And there is this way, you know, I joked about like in my newsletter, because I had shared that, you know, my kids were sick and I was like, this is the glamorous life, you know, of, of an author. And so, yeah, it's this interesting space. And I think the work for me has been to like honor the fact that life continues.
Yes.
And then as I'm able, can sometimes that looks different in different seasons, but to find ways, you know, I think of it like I often use sort of the metaphor of like that holding up your Ebenezer, you know, like of God's faithfulness, like the, you know, the Israelites, you know, use that as a like stones of remembrance that God was with them. God was here. Yeah. And a lot of, I think after any time I've been able to publish something, often that's the feeling, like there's this way of like wanting to at least make something sacred there.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I love
that. To say, yes, all these hard things. In fact, sometimes I would say my launches are like the hardest times because there's so much emotional intensity.
Yeah.
And I think there's like this really beautiful internal, like almost fierce resistance to say, but this matters.
Yes. Yeah.
This matters. And I'm going to honor it.
Yes. And there's so many expectations of how you think you ought to be feeling that week. You know what I mean? And, and that, I think that kind of leads me to the first question I kind of want to deep dive with you is this, what I wrote my second book about was primarily these expectations we have of what the life of faith will feel like. And the guilt that I felt, the shame that I felt when I wasn't experiencing all the good spiritual emotions that I thought I should be having. I thought that, gosh, if I made all the right decisions in life, that I would kind of feel the right way, that yes, I would have struggles, but I would respond to them with kind of an emotional spirit that would honor the Lord. And I thought that if I had all my theological knowledge, you know, all those ducks in a row, and I had a strong foundation for the theology of suffering, that I thought that theology would kind of buoy me up out of the difficult emotions, and that I would feel only the happy emotions like peace, joy, serenity, love, all of those things. And so when I felt disappointment and frustration and even debilitating anxiety, I felt deep, deep shame. And some of that shame was put on me by unhealthy shepherds in my life, pastors telling me it was a result of a poorly formed theology that I was feeling that way. So what I want to know from you is, you know, what do you wish the Christian world knew about the reality of mental health struggles? Maybe what would you tell pastors if you could tell pastors anything about it? What do you wish that we knew?
Yeah. Well, first, I just want to honor what you've shared, because I think that, you know, what you share, I think, captures the experience of a lot of people, which in and of itself captures this feeling of having to be divided internally. Mm-hmm. Like there's, and it's not just that it happened, it's that it's, how else could it be? Mm-hmm. Like, of course you're divided, because it's sort of like, you know, I work a lot in the realm of like things like attachment theory. So understanding that we're innately wired to need connection from our earliest breath, and why that, I mean, it is a literal driving force in us. And so, for example, when you talk about that, like it's this, that because there's this expectation of how you're supposed to be. And if you separate from that, maybe you won't have the connection you need.
Yeah,
right?
That's right.
So it would make so much sense that there would be this internal division of like, hey, I'll show up and I'll say the right things and I'll look the right way, because this is sort of what's required of me to belong. But internally, when I'm really honest with myself, here's what I know.
Yeah.
Here's what I'm actually feeling. So I partly just want to summarize that, because I think that there's honestly my books, in a way, are the things, right? Like that I want, not just first and foremost, I think I write it for survivors, but I hope, and I've been so honored that many, many, many pastors have read my books, and I always feel I'm really grateful when I hear that. And yeah, just like that's a privilege that they're listening. But I think one of the core tenets for me that keeps me connected, to a life of faith, and particularly the Christian tradition, is Jesus's incarnation. I mean, for me, I think that, so one of my primary sort of, theories that I work from is a lot around like somatic psychology, body centered. And one of the things that I think is phenomenal about Jesus is that here's God fully, fully human. Now, I think that on the, on like we talk about that in Western culture kind of flippantly. Like, I think we sort of are like, fully God, fully human. Next, you know, like we move on. Right. So, but for me, as someone who's not only a trauma therapist, but a trauma survivor, like when you get into the granularity of understanding our bodies and understanding the essentialness of being able to inhabit our God-given bodies, like how closely that's tied to healing and wholeness. I think for me, what comes up time and time again is wanting to encourage a curiosity between the gap of what we say we believe or what we know and what we live. One of the things I talk about in Try Softer, I coined the term functional Gnosticism. And what I mean by that term is, you know, so Gnosticism, this heresy that was, you know, sort of refuted that, that spirit, is not more valuable than matter, essentially, right? So we say, so often I think in practice we affirm that. I would say, I would say in word we affirm that. But in practice, what we tend to live out in a lot of our churches is that functional Gnosticism that says, you know what? No, your body, it doesn't have anything to teach you. God can't speak to you through your body. There's not this inherent wisdom that God has placed in us. And what I would say is that I, what we see both through lots of science and research and what I have had the privilege of seeing time and time again in almost 20 years of practice as a trauma therapist is like why it matters so much that Jesus came in a body.
I love that. It's something I've been thinking a lot about too, this duality of that there's this, there's our spirit or our minds, and then there's our body, and our body is bad. Our body can't be trusted. Our body is fleeting. Our body's going to pass away. I mean, a lot of it comes from like a faulty theology of the body, a faulty theology of resurrection. Resurrection is not just that our spirits are going to float up in the air into a happy heavenly place, but our actual physical bodies are going to be made new and go with us. But I think that has always been just something I absorbed growing up in church culture and Christian culture. Maybe it's a misunderstanding of the Greek terms for flesh. And, you know, there's so much that has led up to us believing that our bodies are bad and that our bodies are misleading and that our bodies aren't valuable and that our bodies and spirits are not going to be in alignment. When I think about Jesus, I love how you talk about the incarnate kind of presence of Jesus. Cause like, think about his body in the Garden of Gethsemane in complete alignment with his spirit, like understanding he was going to face death on a cross and his body reacting the way that it did, right? Like, have you ever heard some people, I've heard some trauma therapists say Jesus was having a panic attack in the Garden of Gethsemane, like a totally warranted one, you know? Like, I think it's so fascinating.
I mean, I think the full humanity of Jesus, in my opinion is a love letter. And I think that to me, like in why I often say like this, it's not to say that there are not other parts of my faith that are valuable, but because of like God didn't have to come in a body. It didn't have to be that way. And so understanding that like from both, there's like an attachment lens, there's a somatic lens, there is, you know, a theological lens, this valuing of the way that for God to fully inhabit God's humanity means that we are invited to inhabit ours, right?
Yeah.
And actually that this is, and this is where I think probably the crux of the question is so many people think, well, what will happen if we fully inhabit our humanity?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so certainly I want to be mindful that yes, things can come out sideways. Yes, we are not perfect. We certainly have things that we need to be mindful of and that we need to make repairs. And we, you know, in the essence of the word repentance, those things matter, right?
Yeah.
But when Jesus talks about that I came that they may have life and have it to the full, right?
Yeah.
I think there's this connection, and this is not new. I mean, there's so many Christian writers, right, who talked about this and throughout the scriptures, that there's a way in which that we, as we do this work, and it's not only body, right? Because our soul and our, you know, our mind, these things are all part of who we are. But I think historically, the body has been the thing that has been the least valued.
Yeah.
And what we're finding so much is that these things are not in opposition to each other. Right. That as we learn to, you know, sort of stay connected to God, stay connected to, I believe, our true self, to be connected to others, we become most truly who we were meant to be, not less, but more.
Yeah.
And so I think that's my hope and desire for so many folks in the faith to understand that, you know, I think that certainly there's nuance, there's all those things. We absolutely can bring that to the conversation. But I think that getting curious about this and understanding, that this is really, this is part of what Jesus's work, was about.
Yeah. Yeah. A God who subjected himself to death, to trauma, to loss, to, and to joy too, like into like the full spectrum of the human experience. I do want to talk for a moment about trauma, because you spend a lot of your time addressing that in your book. And I feel like trauma, the word, the term has become a bit like how we use the word love, you know, like you would say, I love chocolate chip cookies, and I do. And I love my daughters, you know, so, so how can this word be used to describe both those types of affections? And I think trauma is starting to become a word that's getting thrown around a lot in society today, sometimes without the care and the intention that it needs. And I wonder if many people haven't actually heard a clear definition of this word from a trained clinician or a trained counselor, licensed counselor, as you are. You bring the credentialing, I think, to offer us a definition of this. So could you maybe offer your most basic definition of trauma?
Yeah. Yeah. So my most basic definition would be to say that trauma is any experience, sensation, emotion, any of those things that overwhelms our nervous system's capacity to fully cope and process what we're experiencing.
Yep.
So to unpack that just a little bit, I think this is, so this is purposely a very broad definition, and I'll try to get a little bit more nuanced, but I start broad on purpose because a lot of, you know, for example, like if we went straight to like the DSM, the diagnostic, so, the statistical manual, which is what clinicians use to like diagnose, there are really specific criteria that need to be met, for example, to have PTSD. And I think that there's value to that. And it's not to minimize the reality of meeting that criteria and being able to understand that. However, what I would say is that historically, we're certainly in this time where there's like all this chaos around beginning to talk about trauma.
Right.
But I would say I am, as much as it's not being always handled well, I am glad that it's being, or it's starting to be more talked about. And I would say there, it has been so not understood and so swept under the rug.
Yeah.
right? So we have this disembodied culture that has for, you know, Western culture is so deeply disembodied. And where there is disembodiment, there tends to be trauma.
Yeah. Right.
Now,
right.
It doesn't mean trauma can't be in places where there, you know what I mean? Like there's, there's nuance to that, but it flourishes in disembodiment.
Right. Right.
Because it's only by inhabiting our bodies that trauma can process, right? That goes back to our conversation about Jesus. So to come back to this definition that trauma is anything that overwhelms that that nervous system's capacity to fully cope and process. What we're saying is that from a functional lens, it's sort of like our body is always processing and metabolizing our experiences, our memories, our emotions, all of these things. And what happens is it's almost like when we eat food, we metabolize food, we keep what we need, we leave what we don't, you know, like there's a way in which there is a, there's function and there's almost like a wisdom to that. Like our body knows what to do.
Yeah.
In a way, it's almost for trauma, it's almost like when you have something that your body's like, sorry.
Yeah.
Can't do it, can't metabolize it, can't digest it. That is trauma. Like that becomes the trauma.
Yes.
And so what happens is that experience gets fragmented in the body. So it's like the sense you might have like a disparate sensation and then a disparate sound and a disparate image. You might have, you know, these different things in your body. So I think why this is significant is because once we understand that, then we can understand, okay, there's this whole spectrum, right?
Yeah.
From the point of where it's like, oh, it's that kind of experience that leads, like maybe it's a PTSD kind of experience, or perhaps it's an experience that is maybe like you're still able to function, but your body didn't fully process it, right?
Yeah.
So like, let's say it's related to being shamed a lot as a child and someone in your adulthood looks to you in a, looks at you in a similar way. Maybe your parent looked to you when you were shamed.
Yeah.
It may bring up the same nervous system body state.
Yeah.
Into your right now moment.
Yeah.
As you used to experience when you were a child.
Yeah. Yeah.
So within this, obviously, I mean, I won't go on and on about it, but what I'll say is that there is a spectrum and there is a way in which I think it's valuable to understand that trauma is as much about how someone experiences a situation as the situation itself.
Yes.
Not to say that the situation doesn't matter, but two people could go through the exact same experience. And let's say someone, let's go back to it being a child example. Let's say one kiddo had really supportive parents.
Yeah.
Where they felt safe. It was good enough parenting, all these things. They go through something difficult at school.
Yeah.
They come home, they experience the safety of their parent and maybe they work through it and it never becomes trauma.
Yeah. Yeah.
You take another kiddo whose parents are stressed. Maybe they're extremely avoidant. Maybe they are not able to give the support needed to that kiddo. That distressing experience may very well likely become a source of trauma for that kiddo.
Yeah. See, that is so helpful. And for me, especially because I think I spent a while feeling a bit smug and maybe tender about this term trauma because I had worked for 10 years in the international aid context. I did, I helped provide staff care support structures for staff living and working in the field. So people who had experienced what, you know, I would say is pretty obvious trauma in terms of the experience itself, like, oh, that could easily be seen as a traumatizing event, being shot at, being threatened in a war zone, being, you know, experiencing an earthquake, all of these things. And so my job was to help maybe come in and do an initial critical incident debrief and psychological first aid. I was not a clinician, but I could connect them to clinical counselors then that could help them. And so when I hear people talking about, well, that hard conversation with my boss was traumatizing, I would kind of get a little, I would kind of bristle inside and say, well, gosh, I've been working with people in a war zone all day. So you don't have any idea what trauma is. And then I'd feel, you know, really smug inside and proud of myself and the work I was doing. But I think what I am learning is that because I worked with plenty of aid workers who actually had those experiences and they were able to kind of metabolize those experiences well and move forward. And it didn't seem to, you know, overwhelm their normal coping mechanisms, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so I think the way that you just explained that really helps me understand that it is often not the event itself. It is what a person brings to the event, their past experiences, their own internal wiring that creates an event that may or may not overwhelm them, if that makes sense. That's so helpful, I think, to hear. And helpful, I think, in a church context, because I think I think what I'm hearing you say is it's better maybe to kind of rein it in, like, let's get trauma out there. Let's get this idea of talking about it and knowledge and being trauma-informed. Let's get it out there into the public forum. And then we'll kind of work on shaping people's understanding of it in a more careful, nuanced way. Better that than keep it stuffed in a box and hidden away and not talk about.
Sure. No, yeah. I mean, a couple of things I do just want to say is, like, I think it's the both and of both what you bring to the situation. Mm-hmm. So previous experiences of both neglect mm-hmm. and or what would be considered, you know, more overt trauma are going to make you more susceptible to being re-traumatized, mm-hmm. basically. Yeah. But also, and here's where this is actually where I get really excited as a mm-hmm. clinician and in the work that I do, because what happens during and after a potentially traumatic experience really matters. Mm-hmm. And this is why I'm so, not the only reason, but one of the reasons I'm very passionate about talking about trauma, because what it means is that things that could become traumatic don't always have to become traumatic. Mm-hmm. And this is why I'm even so passionate about teaching churches and talking to people of faith about our bodies and things like that. Because again, these are the things, these are the fundamentals, right? Mm-hmm. That cause us to say, maybe you haven't experienced trauma, but if you're alive in 2024, then there's a good chance you might.
Yeah.
And when you do, I hope that you will have what you need to mm-hmm. help support you, to know that it's okay to feel your feelings and name your pain and find safe people. And know that God is with you and connect to your body, right? Because all these things actually are both, they're reactive to when traumas happen, but they're also preventative. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because the more that we know how to do those things, it's sort of a musculature of the nervous system. Mm. Because what, you know, those aid workers that you name, they maybe have had some practice.
Yeah, that's right.
At learning how to listen to their bodies and mm-hmm. feel and what do they need and who do they need to talk to mm-hmm. and what needs to happen next and how, what do they need to mobilize in order to feel like this event mm-hmm. is now over,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So the one other thing I do want to just name too, and this is something that I try to always talk about when we're talking about this push and pull of trauma, right? Is I am very passionate about giving people lots of space to be honest about their pain.
Yeah, right.
Whatever that pain is. Mm-hmm. Like, because suppressing pain is never ultimately. Now, that mm-hmm. doesn't mean we get to do whatever we want with our pain.
Right, right.
But honoring our pain is always going to be the path. I mean, there's never a time that healing will not involve honoring the pain.
Right, right.
And that's almost always has to be the first step. Like, I honestly can't think of a time that it's not.
Yeah.
But what I will say, and this is where I think we need to be very careful, and I wonder if this is some of what you see mm-hmm. In our culture, is that we need to be mindful that when we have experienced pain, that we don't weaponize it. Mm. Mm. And this is the place where I think where things get tricky with trauma conversations, right? Because what can happen if we're not careful is we start to get entitled mm-hmm. to harming other people because of our pain, right? So if we have a trauma history or a trauma experience, it still does not mean that we then get to use that as a reason to cause harm or to do things that are, you know, out of alignment or that are disproportional. Right. And certainly this is not to say that we can't or shouldn't advocate for ourselves or set boundaries.
Yeah.
That is a different category. But what I think is tricky about the trauma conversation is, to me, that's the edge. That's that's the edge where it turns from being like, hey, let's honor the humanity that we all have, which is that, you know, something like, I want to say 70% of adults will experience an event that has the potential to be traumatic in their life.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
And I would say, honestly, I mean, that's like a statistic that I had recently seen, but honestly, like folks, if like, I wouldn't be surprised if that statistic honestly is even higher.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think honoring that this is in some ways a universal experience, that doesn't mean everybody will develop PTSD. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean everybody will carry that trauma. Mm-hmm. It means that there's that potential. And so this is the work in a way of loving our neighbor as ourselves, you know, and this is another concept that I pull on a lot because there's a mutuality embedded in our humanity, which is that it's an essential for us to learn.
Yeah. Yeah.
To honor ourselves and listen to our own bodies. And in so doing, what is, I think, really wired in us to happen if we're doing it in a way that's, it's a healthful way, is that we will ultimately learn to honor others and honor that others have stories and have pain. Yeah. And that doesn't mean we need to, again, like I want to be mindful of folks who've experienced harm and those things. It doesn't mean that we need to not advocate or not set boundaries or not do all those things. But to me, that is the place where I think we need to be careful.
Yeah.
Especially.
Gosh. That is very well said, and said, I think, with the precision that's required when talking about these type of very nuanced issues. You know, you talk about honoring pain and honoring our experiences, and yet we live in this culture where our society and the religious and spiritual forces have kind of led us to insist on unflinching strength in every situation. And we tend to shame people who show weakness or express their needs. Why do you think we do that? What is about us in modern Western America, in evangelical, you know, Christianity? Why do you think we do that? Where did that come from?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree. And I think this is part of the dynamic that led me to write Strong Like Water.
Yes.
Because, you know, growing up for me, I was always considered quote unquote strong. Like I was seen as being a person who didn't need a lot, who was very capable. I achieved a lot. But I was experiencing pretty, like very significant trauma in my family of origin.
Yeah.
Have had to carry that and unpack that and, at profound cost to myself.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that has always been this rub in me is that I knew in a way that I was very strong. And I hated in a way that I was very strong. And I hated that people couldn't see. Maybe hated is not the word there, but it was very painful.
Yeah. Lonely.
It was lonely and painful to feel like, that's it. Like, that's the only way for you. Right. And so, you know, in my work and in my own healing work, but also with clients and my own research and work, you know, interacting with readers and all those things, what I began to see is, so first of all, we definitely have this very Western idea around strength. Right. And there's this very, again, it goes to this disembodied picture of like, don't complain, put your head down, don't have any needs, right?
Yeah.
Which you can only really do if you are disembodied.
Right.
Right. So, so it literally requires disembodiment. And then what happens is you're praised for the disembodiment.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that gets very confusing because again, we're wired to belong.
Yeah.
So if you think that you need to literally disconnect from yourself in order to belong, it puts you in these catch 22 situations where you're like, I want to take care of myself, but I can't because then I'll lose my belonging.
Yeah.
And my belonging is essential to my survival. So I have to choose between both.
Yeah.
Do I take care of myself or do I survive?
Yeah.
Pretty tough space to be in.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So my work and my hope has been to actually, like, there's this great quote by, you know, the Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu, which is what is soft is strong. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, and this is a very, very much from like, I think Asian culture and like, there's just so many beautiful examples of the way that there's this fluidity and that how this speaks to that. This is this very specific, in many ways, more effective strength. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I think we see this all over our understanding of current psychology and things like interpersonal neurobiology and polyvagal theory. And I mean, there's just these pictures of, oh, it's flexibility.
Yeah.
It's fluidity that is like our deepest strength. And that kind of led me to want to write about not dismissing this survival kind of strength, right? And I think that's really important. I really try in my work and in my writings to not just automatically dismiss.
Yeah.
Like the way that things have needed to be.
Right.
I think there's a lot of people who are exhausted from being so strong.
Yeah.
Right. Exhausted. I know I've been there in my life. And they don't know that there's a different way. Yeah. And I think that's oftentimes we actually, that's, you know, when you talk about the honoring of the pain, we have to honor that, like, oh, that has served a purpose. Mm-hmm. And sometimes may even still serve a purpose. Like when we are in situations that are life or death, or we perceive to be deeply threatening, maybe that's the strength that we just have to tap into. Mm-hmm. Like, and thank God for that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank God for that, right? Because there's a way in which the wisdom of our body says, look, we got to go to like the emergency switch.
Yeah.
So we're going to do this thing, right?
Yeah.
And then as we are able and as we experience connection and safety and some support, we can sort of take off some of that armor.
Yeah.
And access a little bit more of that fluidity and flexibility that speaks to that, you know, in Strong Like Water, I talk about it, as having a flow of strength.
Yes.
So going from situational strength. And then as we feel a little bit safer and more resourced, we get to this, transitional strength. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately, as it fully metabolizes through our body, it becomes this integrative strength.
Yeah.
This deep inner grounded knowing. That what we have gone through, that we can learn from, that we are capable, that we sort of bring that with us wherever we go. And so to me, it's just really this testament of both, I think, God's goodness to us. Mm-hmm. And it's also like, I just think, our bodies are phenomenal.
Yeah.
Like we are miracles. We are miracles walking around, and both not only our capacity to survive really difficult things, but also the ability to heal and ultimately thrive, even after profoundly difficult and distressing experiences. I think that's just phenomenal. Yeah.
Your book, Strong Like Water, really helped, I think, me name what had happened to me in the last 5 years, where I had this incredible loss, profound, like the atom bomb that went off in my life of losing my sister, and feeling like in many ways I wasn't naming or process, you know, people are like, well, you need to process your grief. I'm like, I don't even know what that looks like, because I'm just trying to keep my baby alive. I had just had my own baby. I'm trying to keep my sister's babies alive. I'm trying to take care of my parents. I'm trying to do all these things. And so, you know, it's crazy the shame we heap on ourselves when we think we haven't done things or felt things we ought to feel. But I was like, well, I feel bad that I haven't processed my grief fully. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And now after reading your book, I can kind of say, that was my body's way of surviving. That was how I survived in that moment. And I can be proud of the presence that I brought to that space. And also, I can recognize that now, 5 years later, I am starting to feel some of that physiological impact of that loss. And now is the time to kind of maybe work on that, do that healing work. So the journey is meandering for me, and it fits and starts, and it's 2 steps forward, 3 steps back, and all these things. And that's okay. Like, that doesn't mean that I'm failing at this grief thing. Doesn't mean that I'm failing. You know, we don't get grades for mental health. We don't get grades for our grief, and our grief journey. It's just the way that the road has taken me, and my body's doing a good job. My body is still helping me be in this world, and I need to continue to listen to it and nurture it. And your book, I think, really helped me kind of feel the freedom to do that with honesty, if that makes sense. So yeah, I want to thank you for that. And thank you for just giving me the language to kind of describe what had happened to me, you know?
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing that. And I think it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I'm so glad that it gave you some language. And also, like, I think something I just really believe as a value is that, you know, our bodies go at the pace they can handle.
That's right. Yeah.
You know?
And, yeah. And I can't tell you the number of aid workers I've sat across from drinking coffee who have said, I think I should be processing what just happened to me, but I'm not, I can't, I don't know what that looks like. I can't journal. I can't do it. And they're like, you know, they're all high achievers. So it's like, what do I need to do to tick the box? And they struggle to just be and listen to their bodies and to just accept the journey that they're on. So I think your work and your words are an incredible resource for people who feel that pressure to do everything just the right way. And yeah. to whatever the hack is for trauma or whatever the hack is for grief, let me find it. I think you help people see, no, that's not how this works. And also there is hope and there is healing, you know?
Yeah. No, I thank you for saying that. And I think, yeah, I mean, this is the paradox, right? And this goes back to my first book, The Tri-Softer, right? That it's like, I think we like so often, and I resonate with this in my own story, but just like this feeling of like, let's fix it, get through it, you know? And the irony is that by bringing compassion, by honoring, by saying, oh, you make sense. Like you make sense. It makes sense that you don't have no idea what's next. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That makes so much sense.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that there's this way in which we stay there. Mm. We stay at that place of needing to, it's almost like we're getting enough nourishment until we're ready to do anything with that.
Yeah.
And we don't know. That's going to just look really different for every single person.
Yeah.
Like it takes as long as it takes, but like that validity. And this is why I am so passionate about continuing to talk about trauma and to educate people and to empower them. Because when we do this work, what ends up happening is that we grow our capacity to really almost like be permission givers for other people to do their work.
Yeah.
Oh, and if we want to be a world that actually do, if we want to create a culture, if we want to create a Christian tradition that creates space for people to be fully embodied, like this is the granular work.
Yeah. Yeah.
It changes from being like, oh, only the people who've had like quote unquote, these things happen, have permission to being like, oh, this is about being human. You are invited to enter the dance of your humanity. Like this is the work.
Yeah.
And God is with us. God meets us. God, like Jesus himself embodied this work, right? By being fully human and feeling all the feelings that come along with that. That's our invitation too.
Mm.
At whatever pace that we can handle.
Yeah. Well, Andi, I feel like we could talk for hours and maybe we'll do this again sometime because I still have so many questions, but I want to give you the opportunity to tell people, where can they find you? Where can they find your new book and hear more of what you have to say on these topics?
Yeah. Well, I've just loved this conversation. But you can find me on my website, andikolber.com. I have lots of resources there. Feel free to join my newsletter. There's some resources connected to that. Strong Like Water Guided Journey, you can get wherever books are sold. And I do have videos that accompany that. So when you get the course, sometimes I think just having someone sort of come alongside you, I'm the type of learner who sometimes needs to get it from a couple different places.
Yeah.
And so those videos are kind of like this gentle way to help continue to unpack the concepts so they feel more accessible. So wherever books are sold.
Awesome. Thank you. And thank you again for your incredible work. It's wonderful to finally talk with you.
I'm so glad we got to be together.